Hello, everyone, and thanks for joining today. This is the Cloud Computing Show, Episode 3. My name is Gary Ornstein. I'm the Vice President of Marketing for Gear 6. And today we're joined by Robin Harris from Storage Mojo. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Gary.
Thanks for joining us today. I want to spend a few minutes talking about some industry news, and then we'll get into some more specific discussion topics around cloud computing. And I guess the big news that we saw recently is HP's acquisition of EDS, and I wanted to ask you, Robin, if you thought there was any relation to cloud computing here, particularly with EDS's business on, managing data centers, and could that possibly evolve to managing cloud computing centers? Any thoughts on that?
Well, I think for HP to move into that space in a big way, they really need to have the technology to do it. And as near as I can tell, at least from a storage perspective, they aren't doing very much in that arena. So I wouldn't expect that they're going to be making a major move there, at least on the storage side of cloud computing.
Right. Some people were mentioning that this is the reunification of the original Loud Cloud, which was Marc Andreessen's company, which then became Opsware. I think at some point EDS had purchased part of the service business of Loud Cloud, and then the software evolved into Opsware with HP. Now they're sort of both under one umbrella. Have you followed any of that activity?
A little bit. But again, to me, the basic issue is you've got to have the technology to make cloud computing work in a basic infrastructure perspective. And, Opsware may be wonderful from a management perspective, but unless HP has the cluster storage, and I know they've got the cluster computing side, but unless they've got the cluster storage capability, they're not going to be able to really move into this arena very strongly. Now, they are reselling Ibricks, which is a very good thing, but when I look at what EMC is doing with Maui, EMC is definitely several steps ahead of HP in this area.
So from your perspective, HP needs to beef up the core technology portfolio with components that will actually help build a cloud computing data center from the ground up, and they're not quite there yet, is what I think you're saying.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Well, we'll have to keep our eyes on it and see what other things they might look at to beef up the portfolio, so to speak. Well, let's move into some specific discussion topics. One of the things you've mentioned previously, Robin, in some of our discussions is that for cloud computing to really take off, people are going to need to re-engineer the applications. What exactly do you mean by that?
Well, as soon as you're operating across the internet, you've got a lot more moving parts behind an application. And we have enough issues in just traditional data centers with resources not necessarily being available, latency being a problem. And as soon as you expand your infrastructure across the internet, you've now introduced a bunch of new potential problems. When you look at the applications that have been successful across the internet, like, Google is probably the best example, but also Salesforce.com, you have a user who's not particularly latency sensitive, inputting a fairly modest amount of data, and then the system at the other end delivering up however much data they need. These are not high data rate or high data volume applications on both sides that are going across the internet.
Right. So I guess the classification then that you're saying is that some of these applications that are a little bit lighter weight in terms of data intensity are the ones that are going to be most prone to migrate into the cloud, so to speak.
Yes, that's an important piece that sort of says, okay, here's the target, the total available application market, let's say. But the other thing that Salesforce.com did that was extremely smart was around that they built a very compelling business case for using them. And that business case simply was, for a very small amount of money relative to building your own infrastructure, you could get started with Salesforce.com. And, for smaller companies, for growing companies, it just economically was just a very compelling piece. So that's the second part of it. You know, one is the technology and, you know, is the application suitable? The second part is, are you able to build a compelling business case around that application? And they've done it, and other people have had a problem with it.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the other reasons why that Salesforce.com company and application was so successful is that it was targeting salespeople who were out of the corporate office anyway, right? And that they didn't have LAN access to a server where they could do their application. And so that was sort of the low-hanging fruit in terms of the users of the application, given that they're sort of on the internet out there in the remote office anyhow.
Right.
Does that make sense?
It's that low bandwidth issue, mm-hmm. right? And you know, for the salespeople, the latency isn't nearly as critical as access to the information.
Right.
And, you know, if they had to wait half a second to get their data or 2 seconds to get their data, they were happy to do it, because when you're in sales, it's hard to know exactly what you're going to need, you know, 2 hours before you need it.
Right.
Customers change.
If we're talking about applications that are, you know, human end user facing, I mean, is there any human who can out bandwidth the internet in terms of what they can, you know, type quickly enough or receive quickly enough? I mean, couldn't you make a case that any time that there's a human on the other end of the chain, you should be able to deliver enough information back and forth over the internet no matter what?
Well, I mean, you know, an obvious counterexample would be, you know, something like video editing, which is really, it's high bandwidth in both directions.
Okay.
And some people, you know, there are online video editing sites. I've taken a look at some of them. And basically, you upload your video, which takes quite a while, if you've got any amount at all, and then you work on it. And basically, the manipulation, they give you a representation of what you're doing that's low bandwidth, and they do the manipulation their end. And that, you know, that makes sense. You know, it kind of works, but it doesn't give you the control. It doesn't give you the interactivity that having that system locally does.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think has to happen? I mean, is there going to be simply a wall that some applications won't be able to cross in terms of migrating into a cloud computing model? Or are there things that have to happen from a technical perspective that will simply, you know, open the gates to say it really doesn't matter where the application resides?
Well, I think if it's really a business critical application that you're doing, you have to figure out how the user can use the application without access to the internet. Because it took the phone system something on the order of 50 years to get to that dial tone always on capability that is sort of the gold standard for network availability. Mm-hmm. And the internet is nowhere near that.
Right.
You know, it's a ragtag infrastructure, and you know, we have these failures like a few years ago when the internet in Silicon Valley went down because when there was a power failure, you know, the big local switch that tied into the backbone, there was a power failure, the diesel generator set kicked in, it kept running, and nobody remembered that you had to switch it back to the regular line power. And after a day or so, it ran out of fuel and the switch went down. And, you know, Silicon Valley, the heart of the whole thing, didn't have the internet for a day or so while they were putting all the pieces back together.
Right.
You know, it's an amazingly resilient infrastructure that we built on an ad hoc basis. But if I'm a salesman, am I really going to have access to the internet all the time? Or if I'm doing, you know, document preparation using an internet-based application, am I going to have access to that document when I most need it? And anybody who's spent much time doing this stuff realizes that generally it fails at the worst possible time.
Sure.
So I think, you know, that's part of the re-engineering of applications, you know, for the internet is, you know, how do you deal with sporadic access to the cloud?
Mm-hmm. Right. And we're seeing that on the consumer side with things that Adobe has been working on with their Air platform or their Flex platform to provide offline access. And certainly in terms of the, I think the migration, for example, on the consumer office suites, that offline access has to really be rock solid before people are willing to give up Microsoft Office or equivalent lock, stock, and barrel.
Absolutely. Totally.
So changing topics slightly, a few weeks back, following your visit to NAB, you talked a little bit about the difference between bandwidth and IOPS and latency. And I was wondering if you could just give us a little bit of your thoughts there, and particularly how that may or may not play into some of the activity and interest around cloud computing.
It's been a long-term secular trend that essentially disk drives, especially the large capacity SATA drives, you know, the number of IOPS has been growing very slowly that you're able to get from a single disk drive, whereas the capacity has been growing very rapidly and the cost of the capacity has been dropping. And the reason that still able to use those disk drives is partly there's been a lot of engineering work on the operating system side and database side, so that, you know, you're not trying to do thousands of IOPS when you've only got a few hundred IOPS available, but also because files have been getting larger. You know, I started out when virtually all files were text files, and, you know, before we started getting into, you know, I mean, I used to do a lot of editing of SGML files, which, you know, had all the tags and stuff. It's kind of like HTML today, but it was all text. And so, you know, a 30 or 40K file, boy, you could have a lot of information, even if it was formatted with SGML. And of course, today, you know, you're probably the smallest Word file you can create is, you know, I don't know, on the order of 40, 50, 60K. And then if you put any content in it, and then you start throwing in photographs or, you know, all of this stuff gets huge. And so we've been moving gradually. I mean, kind of at one level, large SATA drives are looking more and more like tape cartridges. But we've also been in a world where the temperature of the data has been cooling, so the number of accesses we need to make to it, or that we want to make to it, is dropping, and the file sizes are increasing. And I think what really struck me about NAB is that I think they're, in terms of where, you know, file sizes are going and kind of where media are going, it really represents the wave of the future. Files are just going to continue to get larger. We're going to have more multimedia. It works for people, you know, better than, you know, simple text does. Mm-hmm. And so as a result, while we're still going to have growth in IOPS rates for leading edge applications, I think bandwidth is going to be the more important issue.
Mm-hmm. So that both from local perspective, but also at bandwidth access to these cloud computing data centers.
Yes, and it's, you know, it's the last mile problem. You know, I'm out here in the mountains of northern Arizona, and I've got a, you know, a megabit and a half, which compared to where I was 10 years ago in Silicon Valley is fabulous. I was talking to somebody who lives kind of in rural Paris, and he's like, well, all I get is 8 megabits. You know, if I was closer, I could get 20, you know. And this is one area where America is just really way behind the rest of the world.
Yeah.
The rest of the world is engineering for these high bandwidth environments, and we're still limping along with the pathetic infrastructure that we have.
Yeah, that is the one area, yes, where we are way behind. That and mobile phones, but they're sort of go hand in hand.
Yes, indeed.
Changing topics, and we'll wrap up on this note. What's your opinion about private clouds? And, you know, how much do you think that companies are going to invest in services that are available from folks like Amazon or Google or Salesforce compared to building and architecting clouds that they might own that may or may not be managed by somebody for them, but really are within the domain of their corporation. What are your thoughts there?
Well, I think that right now, the sort of the cloud infrastructure has yet to be productized. So that, you know, if I was Goldman Sachs with, you know, global 7x24 operations, if I wanted to buy a cloud product or, you know, the components to make a cloud, I really can't. And so this is where, you know, an Amazon and a Google are, you know, ahead of the product companies because they've had to build that infrastructure for themselves. And so they've got a leadership position in terms of making the technology work. And clearly they both have 7x24 requirements, uptime requirements. And Amazon in particular, I think, is, you know, much further ahead even than Google, because they're handling money and they're shipping real products. I mean, their stuff has to work. And so they've solved a lot of the problems. What I see coming, though, is especially the most outstanding example, I think, is EMC's Maui product, which is a layer of software that exists that connects multiple data centers together to create a cloud infrastructure, a global data repository. And I think EMC will be offering that as a service to, you know, companies that can't afford multiple, you know, data centers across the globe. But if I was, you know, if any Fortune 100 company or Global 100 company, the opportunity to build your own internal cloud that's protected by your own security, you know, that's using your resources so that you really understand, you know, what's happening and where it's happening, that doesn't expose your corporate data perhaps to local authorities who may be doing industrial espionage or to competitors, you know, with the same idea. I think it's going to be very attractive to Global 100 companies to build their own clouds behind, within their own infrastructure, within their own data centers. And but the product problem has been, you can't buy it today.
Right.
But I think within 2 years, you will be able to buy it. And I expect to see those companies do that. And then, of course, they're going to have the problem of, gee, now I've got this. How do I turn it into a competitive advantage? And they'll have the capability, you know, because all of these things come down to, you know, bandwidth and compute cycles and storage capacity and, you know, access points. And they'll have the ability to tune their systems for their particular kinds of workloads that, you know, companies that are using, an Amazon web services infrastructure won't have that opportunity. You know, Amazon will be engineering for kind of either their particular issues or sort of, you know, the mass of the market. But if you've got your own infrastructure, you're going to be able to optimize it and tweak the cloud. And instead of having a cloud, you're going to have a hurricane.
Well, on that note, I think we should wrap up. Thanks very much for your time today, Robin. Where's a good place for people to find you and some of the blog activity that you you're so good at?
Well, the number one site is storagemojo.com. Then I've got a video channel on YouTube. So if you just go to YouTube and search for Storage Mojo, got a bunch of videos on there, interviews with industry people, things like that.
Excellent. Well, thanks again, Robin, and thanks everyone for joining us today for the Cloud Computing Show. I'm Gary Orenstein, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye. That was great.
Oh, good, good. I figured you'd like the hurricane.
Yeah, that was good. That was really good.
Yeah.